Chapter 4. Environmental Disasters, Natural and Human-Made. Our exceptional record for increasing life expectancy and managing acute episodes has focused our concern not only on the rise of chronic ailments, but on the physical and chemical world around us, natural and human-made. Far from losing confidence in science and technology, citizens of the developed world have come to expect ever higher standards of accuracy and protection. The psychiatrist Arthur J. Barsky has noted a decision, later reversed, against the U.S. Weather Service for failing to replace a damaged ocean data buoy before a storm killed several fishermen. It takes a big reduction in disease and famine to let people start worrying about physical hazards. But once everyday threats have been sufficiently reduced, extraordinary ones take on more importance. In fact, throughout the severe floods and droughts of the U.S. Depression era, natural hazards did not exist as a scientific or academic field. Nor, despite the influence of writers like Aldo Leopold and Rachel Carson, was there a field of environmental studies. A certain sense of well-being was needed before men and women could advance to a new level of worrying. Concern was justified. The number of the world's natural disasters exceeding 100 deaths did rise sharply in the 1960s. But while catastrophes happened more often, there were fewer of the upheavals that had taken far more lives in the early 20th century. The Indian drought of 1900, the Soviet drought of 1921, and three floods in China in the 1920s and 1930s, each flood producing over 500,000 casualties. Humanity was doing better, but was more conscious of its insecurity. Television helped by personalizing losses that had once been little more than abstract newspaper and radio stories. The story of environmental hazards in North America and in other developed countries is a special case. As in medicine, our response to emergency conditions and to local problems has been superb. But this also has another side. By intensifying our protection against some forms of natural danger, we have sometimes only shifted greater liability to the future, a rearranging effect. We have traded acute problems for gradual but accumulating ones. This is especially true of the environmental disasters affecting energy. The erosion of disaster. If healthier living has made us sicker, or rather has changed the nature of our sickness, safer living through technology has also had its price. Just as we have developed unprecedented means of recovering from an injury or infection, we have a superb network of structures, devices, and social institutions to shield us from hazards. But on a closer look, safety technologies and relief programs have broadened and shifted rather than eliminated our insecurity. We have defused problems by diffusing them. We have exchanged risk to human life for greater exposure to property damage, and then distributed the cost of that damage over space and over time. We have assumed an increasing burden of vigilance along with our protection. Technology is again taking its revenge by converting catastrophic events into chronic conditions, even as natural catastrophes persist. With its high-rise buildings, complex food distribution systems, and vulnerable railroads and pipelines, the industrial world looks more sensitive to calamity than the flatter, simpler, slower-paced third world. Things would seem to be closer to collapsing at the first harsh blow. Even a casual reading of headlines suggests the opposite, however, and statistics confirm that technological living is safer living. One international comparison of the period 1960 to 1980 revealed that below the middle level of national income, fatalities rose sharply with the poverty of countries. Low-income nations had over 3,000 deaths per disaster, high-income ones under 500. Japan lost an average of 63 people in 43 disasters. Peru, an average of 2,900 in 31. Deforestation is promoting floods, landslides, and drought, even as millions of people are pushing into new and more dangerous surroundings like mountain foothills. Rich countries lose fewer lives because they have built up systems, from the local fire department to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, that identify danger and that warn, reinforce, shield, and evacuate. Democratic politics has responded well to threats of catastrophe. Billions of dollars in public works have channeled and dammed rivers, constructed seawalls, and thrust up barriers to landslides. Not all these projects necessarily protect property in the long run. In fact, they may eventually lead, as we shall see, to even greater property damage than would have occurred without them. But they are at least initially very good at what most people would say is the main purpose of safety engineering, preventing loss of life. Unfortunately, what makes life more secure can expose property and, to some extent, life as well, to new risks. When people in the Third World occupy hazardous terrain, they usually have little choice. Population pressures and inequities of land ownership may force them to live in danger. For some North Americans and Europeans, relocation also appears to be out of the question. But for others, it is the feeling of safety inspired by technological solutions that lets them choose dangerous areas for natural beauty and other amenities. From the canyons of Southern California to the foothills of Colorado and the shores of Florida, many beautiful places can be unstable. The same tectonic, atmospheric, and biological facts that have made landscapes interesting can make them hazardous. Suppressing catastrophe and promoting an illusion of safety can lead to a new generation of risks. Storms and floods. Flood myths are almost universal, for good reason. Catastrophe was one of the first revenge effects of agriculture. The soil is most productive in alluvial plains and deltas. Farming societies cannot exist without the fertility of these rich lands. As recently as the 1940s, it was estimated that alluvial soils then fed a third of humanity. Because population has grown rapidly in river valleys in the last 50 years, this estimate is probably equally accurate today. Farming on a floodplain produced and still yields great benefits for a risk that is still not easy to estimate. But the peril of flooding was not a revenge effect. It was a trade-off, and one that hundreds of millions of people have still not been able to reject. Technology has changed the risks of living in a floodplain or tropical storm zone in three ways. First, it has rationalized the risk by letting us map the area most likely to be struck, limiting new development, and giving warnings. Second, it has improved structures to control storm surges and flooding. And third, it has made motorized evacuation easier and faster than ever. Especially in the Third World, the partial application of these technologies can have revenge effects. Flood control systems encourage settlement in flood-prone areas, increasing the risk to life and property. One of the world's worst natural tragedies, the East Pakistan or Bangladesh cyclone of 1970, took over 225,000 and possibly as many as 500,000 lives, partly because engineering works designed to control high tides and salt had encouraged massive settlement on reclaimed land that appeared to be protected. As recently as 1985, another storm surge in Bangladesh killed 10,000. Yet great storms don't necessarily kill so many. Technology may aggravate, but it also mitigates. 2 years after the Bangladesh cyclone, the floods brought by Tropical Storm Agnes in the United States inflicted $3.5 billion in material costs, at the time more than any other disaster in American history, including the Chicago Fire of 1871 and the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. But because hundreds of thousands of people could be evacuated in North America, the death toll was only 118, less than 1% of the fatalities from the Bangladesh cyclone. When Hurricane Andrew struck South Florida and Louisiana in 1992, it exceeded even Agnes's record, leaving 150,000 people homeless and causing an estimated $15 to $20 billion in property damage. But the death rate was lower than it had been during Agnes. 15 people in Florida, 1 in Louisiana, and 4 in the Bahamas. More people may have been injured in removing debris and repairing damage than in the actual storm, hurt by tree branches, glass, and gasoline and kerosene fumes. Andrew killed so few people, at least partly because a new Doppler radar system could analyze the fine structure of distant wind patterns. National Weather Service meteorologists could predict the storm's path with unprecedented accuracy, to within 30 miles. Since 1900, deaths from tropical cyclones in the United States have declined from 6,000 per year to only a few dozen. Yet property damage has soared to over $1.5 billion in recent decades because of the amount of new construction in hurricane-prone areas. This, in turn, has probably been encouraged by better warning and evacuation systems, as well as by insurance. Casualty policies covered an estimated $7.3 billion of the damage from Andrew. Our success in dealing with floods and storms has brought three revenge effects. First, better predictions encourage a confidence that can be perilous. As the landscape historian John Stilgo has pointed out, when trains were so punctual that people set their watches by them, any exception to the schedule could be lethal to people who knew that the tracks were safe. Likewise, the better weather predictions become, the more dependent we become on them. And consider the logistics of evacuation. Anyone who is driven in a Florida rush hour can imagine what it would be like to try relocating large numbers of people in a short time. Yet by 1986, the American Meteorological Society, AMS, could warn that many hurricane-prone areas in Florida and on the Texas coast could require as long as 20 to 30 hours to evacuate, while sudden acceleration of a storm may not leave more than 6 hours' notice. Surveys suggest that coastal residents usually think that 1 or 2 hours should be enough. Long lead time presents a dilemma. Doppler radar cuts false warnings in half, but evacuation calls may still be wrong a third of the time. And nobody can predict how congested highways might be in a massive evacuation, especially one extending to a dense center like Miami Beach or New Orleans. The AMS pointed out a second risk. Severe hurricanes were rarer in the 1970s than they had ever been. When Andrew struck in 1992, many coastal residents had never lived through a major storm. Protection systems continue to improve as a result of past episodes. A 15-foot seawall built in Galveston after the 6,000 fatality hurricane of 1900 held during Hurricane Alicia in 1983. And after 5 incidents in Pennsylvania were declared federal disasters in the mid-1980s, a computerized emergency information network was developed that could save lives in other states by tracking situations and resources for faster response. Despite better forecasting and tighter government measures, coastal states and communities are unlikely to choke off the growth that is so important for them. The cost of better coping with disaster is spread among insurance policyholders and taxpayers and thus becomes a charge against the entire economy. Protection encourages more development of the coasts. It also discourages house buyers from demanding stricter construction standards. Available construction technology could reduce property damage sharply, but at a higher price to buyers or at a lower profit for developers. And it never really rules out the possibility of a new level of catastrophic revenge effect if even a single important assumption turns out to be overly optimistic. Floodplain zoning, for example, bars new housing within an area at risk for a major flood every 100 years, but new suburban housing can and does press up against this still risky border. The long-term risk, at least to property, remains. Drought. Droughts, like floods, show how technology linked to values and political institutions can make an acute, locally urgent problem into a national and chronic one. The most fatal natural disaster of the Third World sometimes seems to be only an irritant in the developed world. In both North and South, cultivators push the land to its limits and beyond. In Africa, South America, and India, population growth and overgrazing have made the land vulnerable to the shortages of rainfall to which traditional agriculture was adjusted. In the United States, the booming wheat prices of the First World War and Henry Ford's gasoline-powered tractor in the 1920s encouraged the illusion that dry farming would make wheat growing on the southern Great Plains both sustainable and profitable. But whether they realized it or not, farmers were cultivating semi-arid lands subject to recurring drought. Through the 1920s, tractors pulling new-style disc plows broke the soil with unprecedented speed as business people bought and plowed up hundreds of thousands of acres of grassland. Expensive combines replaced gangs of threshers. Small farmers went into debt to stay competitive. As the environmental historian Donald Worster has suggested, the realities of natural rainfall cycles and the limits of the soil were no match for the indomitable optimism of the plains farmers. The low wheat prices of the Depression, leading to a desperate need for increased planting, and a severe and prolonged drought from 1930 until 1936, made the plains synonymous with furious black clouds of topsoil, raised, contemporaries recognized, by the very efficiency of the disc plows in uprooting native grasses and pulverizing the earth. And the ecologists of the 1930s saw an angry nature turning against its human controllers. The leading popular treatment of the Dust Bowl, Paul Sears's Deserts on the March, admonished that by, quote, reversing the slow work of nature that had been going on for millennia, plains farmers had caused deserts so long checked and held in restraint to break their bonds, unquote. The mainstream of the New Deal, far from urging more humility in the face of environmental forces, presented instead an enlightened Prometheanism of relief, insurance, water projects, and shelter belts. No wonder that when better times returned after the Second World War, ambitious farmers were again breaking the soil, protesting the cost of maintaining terraces and shelter belts, and fighting efforts to restrict their acreage. Drought returned in the mid-1950s, bringing new dust storms, and the filthy 50s joined the dirty 30s in the region's vocabulary. And after another wave of expansion following the 1973 OPEC oil shock and the Soviet grain sale, there were still more dust storms in the mid-1970s and a major drought in 1983. A combination of politics and technology turned an acute regional disaster into a chronic national problem. Crop insurance and credit have shifted much of the cost and risk of drought to the taxpayers and consumers, and the old-style catastrophes might still return. The geographer Richard Warwick and others have warned that if these social systems and technologies were stressed enough by a future drought, the results could disrupt national and even international economies far more than the Dust Bowl itself did. Earthquakes. Earthquakes also show how technology exposes more people to natural risks, yet can protect their lives from the same risks. Industrial-age building and transportation methods did not create earthquake hazards. Wherever people are densely settled, especially in port cities that are open to the massive tsunamis that may follow earthquakes, casualties could already be staggering before a single steamship or railroad appeared. The Lisbon earthquake of 1755 killed 50,000. There had been deaths in the hundreds of thousands in Chinese earthquakes centuries earlier, and 300,000 in Calcutta in 1737. The industrial society of the 19th century made earthquakes more hazardous mainly by gathering more people into cities. In a sparsely settled interior like America's, huge releases of energy may harm few. The New Madrid earthquakes of 1811 to 1812 were strong enough to reshape the landscape, alter the course of the Mississippi, and topple chimneys as far away as Richmond. One was even felt in Boston. Yet only a few lives were lost. 20th century technologies can multiply the havoc of major earthquakes. Because of our concentration in urban areas depending on long-distance transport and transmission lines for drinking water, electricity, and electronic data, a miscalculation of seismic risk might, in the worst case, have the impact of a Chernobyl or Bhopal. As it is, earthquakes still take an average of 10,000 lives and cost $400 million a year worldwide. Seismologists agree that there is a strong chance of a major earthquake affecting northern or southern California by the year 2020. Estimates have ranged between 10% and 60% probability. Yet, according to Alan G. Lind, chief seismologist of the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, the $100 million cost of a major California earthquake is modest compared to the $15 billion annual benefits of agriculture, energy, and shipping that the San Andreas Fault has made possible. Without California's mountain building and faulting, it would be hard to imagine the Central Valley, San Francisco Bay, the gold fields of the 19th century, the peninsula. The same features that make California earthquake-prone make it resource-rich as well as visually beautiful. Similarly, the towns of the American Midwest are built along rivers and in low-lying areas for transportation and water. Tornado vortices follow these features. Global statistics confirm that lives are better protected against earthquakes now than they were earlier in the century. A growing proportion of earthquakes have taken human life, and world population has soared since 1900, yet the annual death rate from quakes was actually slightly less from 1950 to 1990 than it was in the first half of the century, down from about 16,000 to 14,000 a year. Most of this gain appears due to protection, not prediction. Earthquakes are still difficult to forecast, even in the few areas like California where exposed faults are closely studied. Chinese seismologists may have saved hundreds of thousands of lives by correctly predicting an earthquake near Haichung and other northern cities in 1975, yet they could give no warning for another catastrophe the following year. In 1976, the city of Dongshan lost 250,000 lives, a sixth of its population, and most of its housing, to an earthquake of magnitude 7.8. The technologies that reduce earthquake casualties are those of preparation. Seismology, soil mechanics, and engineering cannot prevent vast damage, but they can, in Alan Lind's words, quote, turn earthquakes into events that, while terrifying, take very few lives, unquote. We are going beyond national maps of seismic hazards to microzoning of sites for soil conditions that can multiply the effects of ground motion or lead to landslides or to the liquefaction that was so prominent in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. Since the 1970s, new instruments have made it possible to measure surface waves and have revealed that earthquakes can subject buildings to acceleration equal to or exceeding the force of gravity, many times what older building codes had assumed. Techniques exist to make buildings far safer in shocks than they are. We know the hazards of unreinforced masonry. Special standards for schools and hospitals have been tested in actual earthquakes. Large buildings can probably be safe in severe earthquakes if correctly reinforced. Bolting houses and mobile homes to their foundations can prevent fires and explosions. Stronger construction in richer countries makes fatalities much lower than in the Third World, especially in the slums of cities like Cairo, where hundreds died in the earthquake of October 1992. During the 20th century, China has suffered an earthquake death for every $1,000 in property damage, whereas the United States has experienced only one death for more than $1 million in property damage. Compare, too, the Dongshan casualties with those of an equally powerful earthquake that struck Valparaiso, Chile, in 1985. It killed only 150 of 1 million residents. Seismic design of Chilean urban buildings made the difference. In the Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989, the high rises of the financial district, designed to meet seismic codes, survived. The low-frame buildings of the Mission District, built before the enactment of stricter codes enforcing new engineering standards, collapsed and burned. The greatest risks, human and material, may not be where earthquakes have caused the greatest damage recently, but where they are likely but less familiar. Lisbon, despite the fame of its Richter 9.0 earthquake of 1755, may be ready for another that could once more produce record fatalities. In the United States, the greatest risks to life may not be in California, but in regions where the danger has received less attention, near St. Louis and in the Pacific Northwest, and even in the high-rise cities of the Northeast. California's faults release great energy when the Earth's plates move relative to each other, but fault lines also dampen shock waves and check their spread. Eastern rocks are older and denser than western ones. A Midwestern or Northeastern quake would affect a far larger area than a quake in California. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has estimated that a daytime quake of 7.6 on the Richter scale could kill over 2,500 people, including 600 school children in Memphis, Tennessee alone, leaving over 230,000 homeless. Damages from a Midwestern quake could exceed $50 billion. Conspicuous earthquake risk has a positive side. California has learned to get ready, if imperfectly, because it has known disaster. Of course, events may once again show that safety measures are inadequate, as they did when the reinforced Nimitz Freeway in Oakland collapsed during the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989. The Northridge Los Angeles quake of 1994 and the Kobe event of 1995 destroyed and weakened buildings, bridges, and transportation lines once hailed for their advanced, robust design. Concentration of populations in densely built suburbs may increase the risk, but most engineers believe that improved education, warning systems, maps of fault lines and expected hazards, better building design, careful zoning, and stricter building codes can continue to reduce the risk to life. Indeed, the most serious problems of Northridge arose not from inadequate building standards, but from failure to enforce them. And even losses, up to a point, have a bright side. Like tropical storms, earthquakes can't be prevented by technology, but their hazards can be reduced and the cost spread over time in systematic reinforcement programs and over taxpayers in regions that are less exposed to the hazard. It has been public policy to turn acute local economic risks into chronic long-term national debt. In fact, California economists credited federal earthquake relief in early 1994 with accelerating the state's financial recovery by a full fiscal quarter. The developed world's experience for all of the alarming gaps and uncertainties shows how well technological change can domesticate, though not eliminate, natural catastrophe. But this security has two high price tags: the long-term cost of relief to the national economy and the local burden of remaining prepared for long disruptions of essential services. Fire, Smokey's Revenge. Unlike earthquakes and tropical storms, forest fires are as much human-made as they are natural. Huge fires have happened relatively recently without apparent human influence. In Siberia in 1915, for example, a record drought helped bring about two vast fires, one of which burned an area as large as Germany. The smoke has been compared to the volume that would result from a nuclear war. But most American conflagrations, like urban fires, were at their deadliest in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In the Great Lakes forests, the technology of concentrating people and intensifying production outpaced the technology of preventing and containing combustion. The logging industry piled dead branches and leaves on the forest floor, while sparks from steam locomotives created a ubiquitous fire hazard. In just one of the great smokes, the 1871 Pestigo Fire, 1,500 lives were lost. 20th century technology has made possible a precarious control of catastrophe. Aviation has extended early warning from the 10-mile horizon of the fire tower and made it possible to drop smoke jumpers, actually a Soviet innovation, and water in remote areas. Infrared cameras can identify fire lines through smoke. New foams can hold back flames using small amounts of water. Communications can mobilize resources rapidly. While fire can still be deadly where development pushes to the edge of forest and wildland, casualties are now remarkably low. Not one person died in the Yellowstone cataclysm of 1988. In August 1992, there were 65,000 fires covering 1.1 million acres in the Northwest, but no death occurred even among the 13,000 firefighters at greatest risk. The largest recent tragedies among fire crews are well below historic records. 12 firefighters perished when high winds fanned a conflagration out of control on Storm King Mountain near Glenwood Springs, Colorado in July 1994, but this was still much fewer than the 25 killed in 1933 in Griffith Park in Los Angeles, let alone the 70 who died in the Idaho and Montana fire of 1910. The superb modern response to disaster, however, has had revenge effects of its own. It has helped create a western forest more dangerously flammable than ever. In the original forests of the West, grassland separated large trees, a landscape sustained by periodic natural fires that burned off small trees and brush. During the Second World War, the real threat of Japanese incendiary balloons targeted at the Pacific forests galvanized the U.S. Forest Service Smokey the Bear campaign. As intended, Smokey sold Americans on avoiding the creation of fire hazards and, of course, on supporting the firefighting budget of the Forest Service. but the talking bear could not expound fire ecology. Decades before Silent Spring and the new environmental consciousness, his Madison Avenue handlers drew no distinction between bad human-set fires and good natural ones. Fire was unhealthy for bears and people, invigorating though it was for the forest. Only later would wildlife scientists discover that surprisingly few large mammals perish even in the biggest forest fires. They seldom even need to run, and may feed peacefully with the blaze in view. Ironically, nearly every time a fire was suppressed, the forest itself was found to change, a process the environmental writer Charles Little has called Smokey's Revenge. Fire suppression accelerated the transformation that logging had begun. By 1968, an article in American Forests described much of the West Slope as, quote, a dog-hair thicket of young pines, white fir, incense cedar, and mature brush, a direct function of overprotection from natural ground fires, unquote. Accumulating vegetation in the forest allowed fire to climb from the understory to the crowns of mature trees, where it could spread more rapidly than ever. When drought turns it into an insect banquet, the new-style forest is ready to explode into flame. And letting loggers remove dry, insect-ravaged lumber is not necessarily a solution. If clear-cutting loggers leave slash, branches and needles, as they usually do, the forest may burn even hotter than it would have before. We can begin working at restoring the western forest, but it probably has been changed forever. In the altered environment, reintroducing fire can have the revenge effect of killing precisely the old ponderosa pines that we want to protect. As debris, duff, has mounted at the base of these trees, their roots have extended above the soil into this loosely packed layer. Trees that would once have withstood fire now succumb to it. Even allowing fire to smolder at low temperatures lets heat penetrate much deeper into these relatively exposed roots than fire scientists once believed. Just when destructive fires in western forests and wildlands are becoming more likely and more intense, nature lovers are building closer to them. Growth-minded officials in areas like the Sierra foothills have obliged by easing restrictions on building in fire hazard zones. In California, 1.5 million dwellings are close enough to wildland to be at risk. In Oregon, 187,000. Their owners' suburban ways invite unwelcome surprises. House shading trees, rustic shakes and shingles, and winding and leafy driveways all invite wildfire to make fatal moves and obstruct firefighters. The fire historian Stephen J. Pine found in the 1991 Oakland Hills fire traumatic proof that an age of exurban fire has brought wildland fire back to the people. The people helped, too, by planting thousands of trees on formerly open land, which had been swept for centuries by periodic fires, just as others built houses on floodplains. In fact, the final twist of fire history, according to Pine and other forest ecologists, is that the western forest has now been so transformed by logging and firefighting that it can never go back to what it was before human intervention began. Most of the great conflagrations since the 1970s have been unplanned consequences of prescribed burns, deliberately set to reduce the risk of major fires by controlled burning. One fire, set to prepare habitat for the rare Kirkland's warbler, ran out of control, killing firefighters and destroying an entire village. Yet keeping hands off natural fires also has its risks. When the managers of Yellowstone National Park let a series of fires take their course in 1988, the fires multiplied to 70,000, burning 4.2 million acres before a $350 million effort halted the flames. Fires on adjacent private lands, promptly suppressed, caused far less damage. Neither fighting every fire nor letting each one take its course is the answer. In Pine's words, quote, there is too much combustion and not enough fire. The fire that does exist is maldistributed, too much of the wrong kind in the wrong places and at the wrong times, not enough of the right kind in the right places and at the right times, unquote. The western fires of 1993 showed even more clearly the revenge effects of firefighting and communications technology. With more and more suburban refugees able to live and work in the urban interface of picturesque, isolated forest-edge housing, firefighters found unprecedented risk. The long-term gains in fire crew safety, achieved in remote forested areas, were threatened by new settlement patterns and new responsibilities. The need to protect lives and houses led to the deaths of dozens of firefighters and the destruction of added wildland, a rearranging effect. One Montana-based writer commented, quote, "People have died this year to make valleys like mine safe for lawnmowers," unquote. Arson was the immediate cause of some of the worst fires, but these became conflagrations because of a fatal combination. Flammable houses set down in wildlands where smaller fires had been routinely suppressed. Meanwhile, the reluctance of managers to set controlled fires is slowly building up catastrophic accumulations of fuels, and big fires are growing bigger still. America has a fire deficit so severe that a single region, the Blue Mountains of Oregon, needs 100,000 acres of annual burning to restore its health. Looking back, firefighting technology and skills have had two revenge effects, helping make forests more flammable and encouraging people to move to their edge, where their property and sometimes their lives are in greatest danger. But even the Oakland and 1993 fires had far fewer casualties than the conflagrations of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. What is new is the constant watch against threats to the forest's self-selected hostages. In one way or another, the response has to be more vigilance, either in limiting settlement, mandating construction and clearance standards, deterring arson, or preparing to fight more and fiercer fires. Beaches, the ocean's revenge. The seashore has its hostages, too. Along with the destruction by storms of life and property, there is a chronic consequence, erosion of beaches. Most coastal geologists now find the shoreline in constant natural motion, driven by waves and storms. Over three-quarters of it is in retreat. The rate of retreat has increased in the last several hundred years for reasons that geologists still do not understand. Rapid retreat occurs even in remote areas where landscape appears largely untouched by human intervention, as in the Barrier Islands on Colombia's Pacific coast. More severe storms and rising sea levels are just a few of the processes that scientists suspect of shrinking beaches. The world's oceans are more than a foot higher than they were 100 years ago. Further global warming is likely to double the rate, and some projections call for a gain of between 4 and 7 feet in the next century. Coastal engineering, stabilizing the shoreline against natural forces, is ancient. But until the 19th century, seashores were workplaces, sites of seaports and fishing villages, barriers guarding reclaimed farmland, not playgrounds. Romantic poets and artists taught aesthetic admiration of the shore. The fashion of seaside holidays and later of year-round bourgeois seacoast living followed. Cultural change converted a natural flux into a technological challenge. Human activities many miles from the shoreline can affect the shape of the coast. Because waves do not strike beaches at perfect right angles, their energy creates currents parallel to the shore, according to one widely accepted theory of shore processes. If this theory is valid, the current is slowly but relentlessly moving particles toward submarine canyons, where it is lost to the beach. Where sand is carried off naturally, it can also be replenished by particles transported by the rivers that empty into the sea, or by erosion of coastal rocks. The beaches of Long Island are really hundreds of billions of fragments of the Montauk Point cliffs and other sources, moving westward by millimeters toward their final resting place in New York Harbor. Meanwhile, at Sandy Hook, New Jersey, 436,000 cubic yards of sand drift northward every year. Where there are no sources of particles like the cliffs, dams trap the sand that would otherwise rebuild beaches. After millions moved to the Los Angeles area, attracted in part by access to natural beaches, new development required flood control dams that have impounded millions of tons of sand needed for the same beaches. At Santa Monica, 1 million cubic yards move southward annually. Inland dams creating new recreational shorelines also have the revenge effect of starving coastal shorelines. Nature takes its most perverse revenge when we try to preserve the shore itself. The 19th and 20th century gentrification of the coast turned beachfront property into some of the nation's highest-priced land. Its owners and residents are accordingly some of the highest-priced and most politically influential professionals and corporate managers. Calls for federal, state, and local action have been hard to resist, even in the budget crises of the 1990s. Coastal engineering starts offshore with breakwaters, built parallel to the coast, of boulders and concrete. By deflecting the energy of waves, they create safe havens for ships and let sand accumulate on the part of the shore that is spared the sea's natural pounding. But even though many breakwaters are modeled after natural features like sandbars and barrier islands, they usually have unnatural results. The rearranging effect is that this sand, which normally moves like a slow river, never drifts to the beaches farther down the shoreline. These beaches consequently erode as their updrift neighbors' beaches expand. The next line of defense is the edge of the sea. Three main kinds of structures are supposed to protect the shoreline. Property owners build small barriers of wood or other materials to maintain a boundary between the sea and their lawns and terraces. These are bulkheads. Government agencies construct massive stone and concrete protective formations along the shore below the high tide line. These are seawalls, and they also build long walls of stone extending into the water at right angles to the shoreline to capture sand that would otherwise wash down the shore. These are groins. As beachgoers, we are so used to these protective technologies that they almost seem part of the natural landscape of beaches. We are aware of them only at the extremes, where no more sand is left and only seawalls remain, as along many parts of the New Jersey coast. Did armoring the coast actually promote the beach's disappearance? Geologists, civil engineers, landowners, and developers debate the question vehemently. On some points, there is agreement. Groins build new beach behind them while starving the beach downdrift, resulting in a familiar scalloped pattern. On other points, there is still too little evidence to make a firm judgment. Because sand flows in both directions between beach and upland, structures can work both ways. But we know enough to say that at least in some places, stabilizing technologies have destabilizing, revenge effects. By stopping the erosion at the bases of cliffs, seawalls can reduce the flow of sand. Seawall building is also contagious. Erosion increases at the ends of a seawall, prodding neighbors into building their own. Beaches often appear to recover more slowly from storms when they are protected. In fact, replenishing beaches by pumping offshore sand may also increase the rate of beach erosion by reducing the damping effect on waves that the sand had while underwater. People concerned about the coasts are likely to continue to dispute when and where environmental revenge effects are happening. Whatever more rigorous research may show, it is clear that the shoreline is a zone of chronic technological difficulty. Just as logging and fire suppression alter the forest composition and fire ecology, compelling more and more vigilance, so beach protection feeds on itself by establishing a new order that needs constant and ever more costly maintenance. And the order is as political as it is technological. Ironies of energy. Just as technological change has made disaster more bearable, but also more feared, it has made energy use less environmentally disruptive, but also more worrisome. The need for fuel drives worldwide deforestation in the tropics, threatening far more species and degrading much more land than the equally profligate use of fossil fuels and nuclear energy in the industrial countries. Western technologies continue to use energy, and almost all other inputs, more efficiently from one decade to the next, and they have the knowledge to do even better. Revenge effects come not from using more advanced technology, but from accepting deceptive solutions in place of costlier ones. And like other revenge effects, they transform a problem by spreading it in space and time. In the 19th century, mine accidents, and especially explosions, happened on a scale hard to imagine. in some counties in Pennsylvania's anthracite country, between 1.5 and 3% of all miners died or were seriously injured each year in the period just after the Civil War. Today, fire damp explosions are so rare that coal mining's occupational injury and illness rate is actually below the average of manufacturing, and the death rate has dropped to 0.04% annually. Mining may still have tragic chronic consequences, especially black lung, but there is no doubt that its catastrophic problems have receded. Just as mine calamities were accepted as the price of industrial might, smokestacks were prized as its emblems. They flaunted sooty plumes in manufacturers' and utilities' advertisements, on their letterheads, even, especially, on their stock certificates. In yesterday's gritty cities, effluence signified affluence. Smokestacks removed some of it from the immediate surroundings of the source. They made the soot go up, and like Wernher von Braun in Tom Lehrer's song, their builders did not ask where it came down. Power plants, factories, and smokestacks were concentrated in and near cities, maintaining an alliance that had existed for centuries. Urban residents in all social classes had access to more goods, services, and information in return for their sacrifice of personal space, and sometimes of health as well. Indeed, the smokestacks of industry probably were not nearly as harmful to urban air as the smoke from coal-burning home and business furnaces, the excreta of horses, and later the emissions of automobiles. As environmental consciousness grew in the 1960s, the belching smokestack became a negative symbol of the excessive price of prosperity. Oil and oil-powered electricity appeared cheap and clean. Houses and industries often converted, sometimes choosing even cleaner natural gas. But many plants, especially electric power stations in the Ohio Valley between Pittsburgh and Cincinnati, were and are still fired by coal. America's vast coal reserves seemed, along with conservation, the answer to the Arab oil embargo and the energy crisis of the 1970s. Burning coal, however, especially high-sulfur eastern coal, produces tens of millions of tons of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides each year. Transported through the atmosphere, these chemicals acidify lakes and soils, reducing the productivity of forests, lakes, streams, and cropland. The National Acid Precipitation Assessment Program, NAPAP, report, released after a decade of research in 1990, discounted the most drastic predictions of environmental collapse from acid rain deposition. It questioned the part of acid rain in forest damage. It pointed to other sources of lake acidification, which it considered a localized problem of New England and the Adirondacks. But nitrogen and sulfur oxides and ozone unquestionably are unhealthy for fish, wildlife, and human beings. The NAPAP report also confirmed what critics of the 1970 Clean Air Act had been saying for years. When utilities built high chimneys in the early 1970s to meet local pollution standards set by state regulators, they were promoting the long-distance migration of sulfur and nitrogen oxides, a rearranging effect. An EPA report of 1976 concluded that using tall stacks to reduce ground-level concentrations had produced, quote, the indirect tendency to increase the amounts of pollutant emitted to the atmosphere, unquote. Until that year, in fact, utilities routinely used what were called intermittent control systems that let them release more pollutants when atmospheric conditions were favorable. The EPA tightened its rules on tall stacks in 1976, but the face of power generating and smelting had already been changed permanently. The average height of electric power station stacks along the Ohio more than doubled from 1950 to 1980, from 320 to 740 feet. In 1981, the United States had 20 smokestacks over 1,000 feet high. A few of the largest reached 1,200 feet, well above the Eiffel Tower and just short of the base of the Empire State Building's antenna. The tall stacks undoubtedly benefit their immediate surroundings. When the smelters of Sudbury, Ontario, for decades one of the unhealthiest places in North America, installed a 1,250-foot stack in the early 1970s, they complied with the Ontario government's mandate to dilute and thus disperse the smelter's gases. Sudbury's air was cleaner, but the result was a massive streak of gases exiting at up to 55 miles per hour at nearly 700 degrees Fahrenheit. But in Canada, as in the United States, the relief of the immediate region did not dissipate the gases harmlessly, as government and corporate officials had believed and promised they would. Instead, the tall stacks made the chemicals a still greater interregional problem. The gases can rise to twice the height of a 1,000-plus-foot stack. At lower altitudes, sulfur dioxide tends to settle on trees, structures, and soil within 60 miles or so of its source. Propelled instead to much higher levels, it remains in the atmosphere and undergoes a series of chemical reactions in which pollution is converted to sulfuric and nitric acid suspensions called aerosols. These can join with other sources of pollution to form acid concentrations that ride prevailing winds toward the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states, sometimes for hundreds of miles. The resulting pollution may cut the autumn view from Shenandoah Park's Skyline Drive from its former 60 to 70 miles to 10 miles or less. In the Virginia mountains, with little or no soil, half the fish species of some rivers and all the acid-sensitive invertebrates have disappeared. Summer rainstorms bring the acids down to earth. Many lakes and rivers are naturally buffered, alkaline enough to neutralize the transported acids. The Ohio Valley itself, with its limestone soils, is far less vulnerable to acid rain than the Adirondacks and Canada. Compounding the irony of the tall stacks is another revenge effect. Beginning in the 1950s, electronic precipitators in chimneys were trapping the soot particles that had once deposited films of grime on neighboring buildings. Only decades later did research show that the soot had actually protected its surroundings even as it had dirtied them. Sulfur and nitrogen oxides in smokestack emissions reacted with it to form environmentally benign compounds. This had a parallel in Washington, D.C. There, until recently, the nightly illumination of the Lincoln Memorial attracted so many midges that spiders feasted on them, and sparrows on the spiders and midge debris. Attempts to scrub away bird droppings and spider webs only compounded the damage by infusing automobile exhaust particles into the marble, weakening it. Changing the timing of the lights appears to have helped. In each case, suppressing a visible and symbolic problem had the revenge effect of magnifying an even more pervasive and serious one. Cleaning up the soot probably was still a net gain, especially for the neighbors of the plants. Particulates now appear even more hazardous than they did 40 years ago, but not as large a benefit as it seemed. In fact, a cleanup can even produce pollution under special circumstances. The restoration of Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel frescoes, which a minority of scholars continue to denounce as vandalism, has helped increase tourist visits. Yet well before the project's completion, the heat of visitors' bodies, vapor of their breath, and sulfur in the dust were already creating an invisible acid rain within the chapel. Some of the revenge effects of acid rain in the 1970s and 1980s were more political than technological. As Bruce A. Ackerman and William T. Hassler showed in Clean Coal, Dirty Air, a bizarre coalition of Eastern high-sulfur coal producers and environmentalists influenced the 1977 amendments to the Clean Air Act to require all plants to use flue gas desulfurizing technology, scrubbers, instead of old-style cheap water treatments or shifting to low-sulfur Western coal. Scrubbers, especially early models, are sensitive systems that need constant monitoring and skilled maintenance. They generate sludge by the ton. Because existing plants did not have to be retrofitted, industry had a powerful incentive to stretch out the lives of high-pollution facilities. If the Clean Air Act had not been amended in 1990 to permit polluters to sell their allowances, the result of the 1977 legislation might have been to add 170,000 more tons of sulfur dioxide reaching the east from the grandfathered Midwest plants. Some utilities and industries might have intended to dump their sulfur dioxide in other states or regions in whatever form their airborne travels and chemical encounters might give them. Some environmentalists were emphasizing this problem as the stacks were built. But most engineers, executives, and regulators honestly believed that transformation and dispersion would be largely harmless. Weren't there critics always proclaiming that the sky would fall? And some scientists did find evidence suggesting that human disruptions of the environment could cancel each other out. In a reverse revenge effect, large parts of the country may be protected from acid rain by the interaction of the acids with carbonates in the dust particles that farming and construction whip into the atmosphere. New England suffered as much as it did from acid rain just because its forests had grown back so vigorously, because it was so green. In the end, it may have been not only the NAPAP report, but the Rio summit that devalued acid rain as an issue. Acid rain receded as concern over global warming advanced. The Tall Stacks movement shows how ironic the results can be of attacking a symbol like the dirty plume of a low smokestack. Oil spills, dispersing pollution. When the Exxon Valdez hit Bligh Reef off the Alaska coast in 1988, the murky discharge of 35,000 tons of crude oil was an ethical Rorschach test. To some, it was simply another example of human failure, resulting from flaws of character and responsibility, and, of course, from drinking on the job. To others, it expressed the heedlessness of corporate capitalism at its worst, the inevitable outcome of putting profits above safe operation. And to still others, the real fault was neither the captains nor the corporations, but the consumers, an inexorable price of the industrial world's insatiable hunger for energy. In fact, as the next chapter will argue, great oil spills threaten species diversity far less than some other consequences of shipping do. They may not even be the ugliest fruits of marine traffic. One report in 1986 estimated that ships and drilling rigs were dumping hundreds of thousands of tons of plastic debris into the world's oceans each year, the U.S. Navy alone accounting for 60 tons a day. Plastics strangle birds and seals, poison turtles, and fatally ensnare whales. But litter, excepting medical waste, isn't newsworthy. Television spreads the more spectacular ugliness of spills electronically around the world, and it would take a very stony-hearted policy analyst to argue that shippers and governments are already spending too much money to prevent them. Decades of mega-spills from the world's growing supertanker fleet before the Valdez affair suggest that the problem is indeed structural. The even larger wrecks of the Torrey Canyon, 120,000 tons in 1967, and the Amoco Cadiz, 220,000 tons in 1978, had already shown it was worldwide. Europe's coasts have suffered much more than America's. And the U.S. National Research Council and others have pointed to a potential technological revenge effect. Computerized design lets naval architects model the result of stresses on larger and larger ships. The Seawise Giant of 1980 has a dead weight of 565,000 tons, though today's very large crude carriers, VLCCs, have typical dead weights of about half of that. Far from making shipping safer, new design technology, like Humphrey Davy's mining lamp, which initially resulted in deeper shafts and more accidents, encouraged owners to push the limits of risk. They specified lighter, high-tensile steel, which saved fuel but could rupture when repeated stresses began to produce small but potentially deadly cracks. Stronger steel is less ductile and more likely to break under some circumstances. In the early 1980s, wings fell off airplanes, storage tanks exploded, and hip implants cracked. It is harder to weld properly, and shipbuilders don't always provide a suitable internal framework. The search for safer designs shows that the conversion of catastrophic problems to chronic ones can sometimes be reversed. When treaties in the 1970s forbade ballast water in empty petroleum tanks, they slashed the steady pollution of seas and harbors from the flushed water. Unfortunately, oil in the higher-riding ships with separate ballast tanks has ever since been under greater pressure relative to the sea. If a hull is ruptured, more oil pours out. The most popular recommendation for tanker safety, adding a second hull about a meter or more from the ship's exterior, might let petroleum vapors seep into the space between hulls and explode. Safety inspections, already covering 1,200 kilometers of welded seam on the vast single hulls, could be so daunting that more sources of leaks could be missed. Keeping tanks partly empty to reduce pressure relative to the sea might retain most oil within tanks in small accidents, but it could increase dangerous stresses in high waves. Pumps to maintain negative pressure after accidents could also promote explosions. And owners argue that larger numbers of smaller, safer ships might actually result in more accidents and more oil spillage than conventional supertankers do now. They also warn of a social revenge effect. If liability under the U.S. Oil Pollution Act is too risky, serving the U.S. market will be left to doubtful operators. Fortunately, there are technological solutions that in time will reduce the risks of marine accidents. Intermediate decks can limit spills from the largest tankers. Automatic ocean sounding and global positioning system satellites can cut the time and expense of producing more accurate and comprehensive nautical charts. And offshore petroleum receiving stations like the Louisiana Offshore Oil Port, linked to the mainland with underwater pipelines, appear to reduce the risk of collision. Once a spill does happen, it is ugly. There is a grandeur in natural hazards, even where they devastate natural habitats, as the eruption of Mount St. Helens did in Washington State and Hurricane Andrew did in the southeast. The horrific images of an oil slick, the struggles of oil-coated seabirds and mammals, the contaminated shorelines, all assault cameras and consciences. They call for technologies to repair what technology has wrought. Unfortunately, the record of cleanup technology has so far been filled with revenge effects of its own. England experienced some of these problems as early as 1967, when napalm failed to burn off the oil from the Torrey Canyon, and shores and harbors were treated to 10,000 tons of chemical dispersants. These turned out to kill many of the remaining crustaceans and other animals and plants that the oil itself had spared. Even in the 1990s, dispersants have potential revenge effects. By breaking down petroleum into minute globules that will mix with water and sink below the surface, they relieve some of the unsightly signs of a leak. They also keep blobs of oil from washing up onto the shoreline and from contaminating sediments. But as the petroleum is free to sink below the water's surface, it is also more likely to harm the reproduction of organisms on the seafloor, from fish eggs to lobsters. Tidying up an oil spill mechanically can have even more serious revenge effects. The $2 billion cleanup of the Exxon Valdez disaster relied heavily on hot water applied to the shoreline through high-velocity pumps, Exxon's response to outrage. A later independent report for the Hazardous Materials Response Unit of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, showed just how unexpected the consequences of purification could be. David Kennedy of NOAA's Seattle office explained, quote, "The treatment scalded the beach, killing many organisms that had survived the oil, including some that were little affected by it. It also blasted off barnacles and limpets, and it drove a mixture of sediment and oil down the beach face, depositing them in a subtidal area richer in many forms of marine life, one where there hadn't been much oil," unquote. A report commissioned by the NOAA suggested that the high-pressure cleanup had disrupted rock surface ecology by destroying mussel and rockweed populations relatively tolerant to petroleum, making surfaces more vulnerable to waves and predators. Fewer mollusks also encouraged opportunistic algae to preempt surfaces from rockweed and red algae. The oil flushed from the surface killed hard-shelled clams and crustaceans in intertidal and subtidal zones. It apparently also reduced the productivity of the eelgrass that shelters young fish and shrimp. The water pressure itself was even more damaging. At up to 100 pounds per square inch, it disrupted the natural sediments of beaches, both gravel and sand, smothering clams and worms. Rescuing animals from spills may also result in revenge effects. Of the 357 sea otters saved from the spill and treated by veterinarians and volunteers, 200 could be returned to the sea. A number of biologists now believe, though, that these spread a herpes virus to otters in eastern Prince William Sound that had avoided the spill itself. The transplanted otters also died in unusual numbers. While some form of the virus appears to be endemic in the waters off Alaska, the treated otters had lesions that could have transmitted the disease, or a more virulent strain of it. Stressed animals are potentially dangerous, and some biologists and veterinarians now favor keeping them in captivity. They also point out that efforts to save the most seriously injured otters may only have made them suffer longer. The Torrey Canyon, and especially the Exxon Valdez disasters, show the perils of purification. Contamination anywhere in the world can become so unbearably visible that it seems to cry out for equally televisable remedies. Exxon officials still defend cleanup methods, even though most scientists now believe a less costly strategy, for Exxon too, would have been more effective. This does not mean that cleanup never works. It should not discourage us from reducing and correcting our degradation of nature, whether chronic or acute. But the big marine spills underscore how complex natural systems are and how creative and flexible human management of them has to be. It is fortunate for us that crude petroleum seeps into the ocean on its own, since natural selection has already engineered bacteria that thrive on it. In fact, the existence of natural pollution of Prince William Sound sped its recovery. Local spruce trees produce hydrocarbons related to those in the Prudhoe Bay crude spilled by the Exxon Valdez. Refined products are less likely to find pre-adapted bacteria. Recovery rates have varied from one site to another, but a study by the Congressional Research Service specialist James E. Mielke underscored the ability of marine ecosystems to recover from even severe impacts. Fishing and hunting have a far greater impact than oil spills do on those species that are harvested. Most species recolonize polluted areas quickly. The closer we look at marine oil pollution, the less catastrophic and the more chronic it turns out to be. During the 1980s, global oil pollution from sea and land disasters like spills, shipwrecks, and fires declined from 328 million gallons to between 8% and 16% of that figure annually. In 1985, tanker accidents accounted for only 12.5% of oil pollution, not much more than natural marine seeps and sediment erosion. In spite of the ban on ballast water in tanks, routine bilge and fuel oil pollution from tankers was almost as bad a problem as tanker accidents, and other normal tanker operations caused as much pollution as the last two combined. Municipal and industrial sources put nearly three times as much oil pollution in the sea as all tanker accidents combined. On land, too, it is smaller leaks, seepage, and waste oil storage, not catastrophe, that pose the most dangerous threats to both wildlife and human health. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has estimated that more than twice as many migratory birds died after landing in open ponds and containers of waste oil in five southwestern states alone in 1 year as were lost in the Exxon Valdez spill. Tank farms and pipelines on a Brooklyn site have been slowly leaking over 1.5 times the spill of the Exxon Valdez. Another tank farm in Indiana is being forced to remedy leaks that could have been 3 times as large. Rusting pipes, bad welding, leaking valves, and sloppy maintenance account for most of the loss. Leak detectors are so unreliable that in January 1990, 567,000 gallons of heating oil were discharged from an Exxon facility in New Jersey where warnings had been ignored after 12 years of false alarms. And the problem extends to the retail level. Richard Golub, publisher of an oil pollution newsletter, has calculated that at any time, 100,000 of America's 1.5 million underground fuel storage tanks are leaking or starting to leak. The safer tanks that local service stations are required to put in their place may leak anyway after careless cut-rate installation. In fact, the chronic leakage problem can turn into a catastrophic risk of explosion if the electrical conduits needed by the new systems are not sealed expertly. Back to nature, the revenge of the stove. While there are many low-intensity alternatives to conventional power, they are no more immune from revenge effects than the massive technologies that we worry so much about. Early 19th century Americans heated their houses and water with wood-burning fireplaces and stoves. Coal, especially cleaner-burning anthracite, became the preferred fuel by the turn of the century, but the open wood-burning hearth retained powerful symbolic ties to the family life of a more wholesome past. Even now, a new working fireplace is one of the few residential improvements that, in contrast to a swimming pool, for example, is likely to increase the market value of a house more than it costs. But there are revenge effects in striving to be natural. One is the extraordinary demand on land. Michael Allaby and James Lovelock have estimated that heating a three-bedroom house entirely with wood needs 3 hectares, about 7.4 acres of woodland, for a sustained yield of fuel. Widespread use of wood in populous areas of the United States, and few Americans now live outside cities and suburban agglomerations, would mean diverting cropland or second-growth forest to firewood plantation use. The energy cost of cutting, air-drying, and transporting firewood long distances is not trivial. Pollution is an even more serious revenge effect of the urge to live naturally. Wood is innocent of contributing to acid rain. It has negligible sulfur. Burning wood produces carbon dioxide, as other organic fuels do. But growing trees absorb CO2, evening the score. But as Allaby and Lovelock point out, wood smoke contains chemicals like benzoapyrene, dibenz-AH-anthracene, benzo-B-fluorinthene, benzo-J-fluorinthene, dibenzo-AL-pyrene, benz-A-anthracene, chrysine, benzo-E-pyrene, and indeno-123-CD-pyrene, known carcinogens shared with cigarette smoke, which, after all, is just another product of burning vegetation. The more slowly and efficiently stoves burn, the more of these chemicals they produce. In addition, a stove operating at low temperature through the night may emit 35 to 70 grams of particles an hour. Some of these particles are now thought to suppress the immune system, increasing the likelihood of respiratory illness. Many householders magnify the problem with stoves that are too large, producing more emissions and hazardous creosote in the chimney when operated at the necessary lower temperatures. And atmospheric emissions from thousands of small units are much more difficult to trap or neutralize than those from large central ones. Towns in the valleys of New England, the Mountain States, Oregon, and Washington were so susceptible to wood stove pollution that many began drastic limits on wood stove use. Telluride, Colorado, even made a homeowner wanting to install a new stove pay 2 other people to remove theirs. Missoula, Montana, installed a light on a water tower to warn residents to extinguish wood fires during air pollution warnings. By 1987, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, had issued guidelines to cut the particulate emissions to 5 grams per hour. Prices of some models jumped by hundreds of dollars as manufacturers added catalytic converters. Production of new wood-burning stoves declined by 80% in the late 1980s. Today, a well-designed stove or enclosed hearth can be an efficient way to use wood that would otherwise be wasted. But the failure of wood-burning as an alternative energy movement proved that simpler, smaller, and more natural doesn't necessarily mean healthier. It also points once again to the difference between 19th and 20th century environmental problems. The wood or coal smoke that often descended over our ancestors' towns and cities was a health menace, but a localized one. Today's vast central generators cause far less environmental damage per unit of output. That's why people are working to replace millions of internal combustion engines with battery-stored electricity from central generators. Catastrophe is hardly a thing of the past. Natural hazards are damaging property at rates well beyond inflation and the growth of the national income. In spite of political innovations like floodplain zoning, we are pushing toward the very areas where nature puts us most at risk from tropical storms, mudslides, and forest fires. Our political and economic institutions offer powerful incentives to ignore danger. In Virginia, 3,000 dwelling units and businesses have been built on a sandy strip in Hampton Roads Harbor, originally formed by a hurricane nearly 250 years ago. an equally powerful storm could wipe it out. A direct hit on Miami could have tripled Hurricane Andrew's cost of $25 billion. If Hurricane Hugo had come ashore in Charleston, South Carolina, rather than at a nearby park, a 20-foot wave of water would have devastated the city. A big storm could leave 20 feet of water in downtown New Orleans and flood evacuation routes. Around the world, weather can still break up supertankers with far more petroleum on board than the Exxon Valdez or even the Torrey Canyon. Federal disaster aid and private insurance, plus a cyclical lull in major storms, have helped reduce perceived risk and have encouraged a 50% increase in shore residents on the Gulf Coast and East Coast in only 20 years. With each generation, part of the collective memory of the last terrible events is lost. When the cycle returns, its fury falsely seems unprecedented. Meanwhile, technological and social devices for protection, whether physical barriers, evacuation procedures, or disaster relief, are overwhelmed. Once more, our cleverness may catch up with us. When we think of advanced technology, we usually imagine structures and devices that work with less and less human intervention. New automobile engine and fuel injection systems have added months to routine maintenance intervals. Computers need professional servicing less often than mechanical typewriters did. But the technological solutions for catastrophic risks show another unintended side of technology. Safety takes more human attention. Sometimes the technology is traditional, maintaining levees and dikes. But new technology requires regular work, too, from testing residential smoke detectors to inspecting double-hulled tankers and maintaining earthquake-reinforced bridges and elevated roads. Our past success in suppressing forest fires and in deferring the natural migration of beaches has tied us to the long-term task of keeping up the artificial regimes we have created. The maintenance compulsion that Albert O. Hirschman identified, the necessity for vigilance that technology imposes, applies as much to natural hazards as to human systems like roads and aviation.